Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
Absolutely. Thanks for tuning in.
So I want you to imagine something. Imagine you were standing in front of like this massive, overwhelming buffet.
Okay, I'm listening.
There are 43 completely different dishes spread out in front of you. You've got everything from simple sugary desserts to, I don't know, dense complex fibers. But there's a serious catch to this meal.
There's always a catch.
Exactly. You only have a highly limited amount of physical energy to actually carry the plates back to your table.
Oh, wow.
So how do you decide what to grab? Do you just take the easy, high-calorie meal you already know how to digest? Or do you spend your precious energy chewing through something incredibly tough and unfamiliar?
Right. It's a huge trade-off.
It totally is.
Yeah.
Now, put yourself in the microscopic shoes of a single cell of Escherichia coli, living deep in a mammalian gut, or maybe out in the soil.
Mm.
E. coli faces this exact logistical nightmare every single day.
Yeah, it constantly encounters this massive chemical diversity of foods. I mean, sugars, organic acids, amino acids.
So the question for this deep dive is, what really happens when a cell is forced to eat its least favorite food? Like, how does it completely retool its internal molecular factory just to survive the meal?
Well, the mechanism behind that adaptation, it really goes to the very core of how life persists in shifting environments.
Right.
Because, you know, when an organism doesn't have a nervous system to make conscious decisions, its genetic code has to do the deciding for it.
Right. It can't just look at the buffet and pick.
Exactly. And it has to do this dynamically. It's constantly reading the chemical environment and like instantly deploying the right cellular machinery to extract energy without killing itself in the process.
Which is mind-blowing. And today we celebrate the work of a brilliant collaborative team of researchers from UC San Diego, Chonam National University in Korea, and the Technical University of Denmark.
Yeah, incredible team.
They've really advanced our understanding of this very process.
Yeah.
They actually mapped out exactly how that microscopic decision-making works in real time.
And their work pushes our understanding of carbon response physiology way beyond the old models. We're finally moving from viewing bacterial metabolism as this simple on and off switch to having a massive, highly detailed systems-level atlas.
A literal atlas of how a cell survives complex environments.
Yes. But to fully grasp the magnitude of this new atlas, we should probably first establish the traditional textbook view of bacterial metabolism.
Sure, we'll set the stage.
So for decades, biology students have been taught a concept called carbon catabolite repression, or CCR.
Right, CCR.
The fundamental idea there is that when a preferred, easy-to-digest sugar-like glucose is available, E. coli will preferentially consume it.
Naturally.
And while it's eating that glucose, it actively suppresses the genetic blueprints required to digest other more complex foods.
So it's essentially putting blinders on, right? Like ignoring the rest of the buffet while it finishes its dessert.
Yeah. That is the functional result, yeah. And biochemically, it manages this through a specific sensory system involving a molecule called cyclic AMP, or CAN-MP, and a receptor protein called CRP.
The hunger signals, basically.
Exactly. Cyclic AMP acts like a cellular hunger signal. So when glucose is abundant, the cell keeps its internal levels of CMP very low.
Because it's not hungry.
Right. And because the hunger signal is low, the CRP sensor remains inactive. So the heavy machinery for digesting other foods just stays locked away in the genome.
Okay, let's unpack this textbook view for a moment, because it makes E. coli sound like a factory boss who only has like a single binary switch on the wall.
Just a giant on-off switch.
Yeah. Either the glucose assembly line is flipped on and all other machinery is completely powered down, or the glucose runs out, the hunger signal spikes, and the boss flips the switch to turn all the other lines on.
Which is a very simplistic way to look at it.
Right, because nature rarely offers a pure glucose buffet. Most earlier studies, I mean, they only looked at bacteria transitioning from one simple sugar to another, which completely misses the messy reality of the gut or the soil.
Oh, absolutely.
And logically, a cell can't just turn on every alternative digestive pathway at the exact same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't building those new metabolic assembly lines cost precious protein resources?
Oh, it costs a ton. Doing that all at once would completely bankrupt the cell's energy reserves.
So how do they manage it?
Well, we can view this through a concept in modern microbiology known as proteome allocation.
Proteome allocation, okay.
Yeah, you can think of the cell as a strict economic system.
Right.
A bacterium only possesses a finite budget of resources, amino acids, raw energy, and most importantly, ribosomes.
the cellular machines that build other proteins.
Exactly. So if the bacterium spends a huge portion of its ribosomal budget constructing complex enzymes just to digest a tough, unfamiliar carbon source station,
it has fewer ribosomes left over to build the proteins it needs to actually multiply and grow.
Precisely. You can't build the factory's defense systems and expand the factory's physical footprint at the exact same time using the same limited crew of workers.
The math simply does not allow it.
No, it doesn't. And this study addresses a massive historical gap in our knowledge. Like, across highly diverse, non-ideal carbon sources, how does E. coli dynamically organize this genetic budget?
And what specific stress responses are triggered when the cell is forced to subsist on a truly poor diet?
Exactly.
Which brings us to the sheer scale of the source material for this deep dive. Because the data set they compiled to answer those questions is, well, it's monumental.
It's called Precise NP881.
Right. The researchers took E. coli K12 and grew it on 43 individual carbon substrates. And these weren't just slight variations of sugar.
No, they were very different.
Yeah, they covered 8 distinct chemical classes, ranging from simple hexo sugars all the way to complex amino acids and nucleosides.
Which is a huge variety.
Right. And to capture a snapshot of the blueprints the bacteria were actively using on each diet, they generated 346 new RNA sequencing profiles.
And RNA sequencing is crucial here because it measures the transcriptome.
Meaning it tells us what's active.
Right. It tells us exactly which genetic blueprints are being read and converted into active machinery at that specific moment in time.
So they took those 346 new profiles and carefully merged and normalized them with existing public data. The result is this massive, unified compendium of 881 different environmental conditions.
It's an incredible resource.
But having nearly 1,000 snapshots of a cell's genetic activity, I mean, that creates a new problem. How do you even begin to process that much noise?
It's a lot of data.
Right. If you just look at the expression of E. coli's 4,000 plus genes, one by one across 881 conditions, you're going to get completely lost.
You would. Traditional analysis often relies on simple clustering, you know, just grouping genes that happen to turn on and off at roughly the same time.
Right, which isn't very precise.
No, so the researchers here applied a far more sophisticated mathematical technique called independent component analysis, or ICA.
ICA.
Yeah. Instead of just looking for simple correlation, ICA decomposes the massive overlapping transcriptional network into statistically independent gene expression modules.
And they call these modules.
Imodulons.
Okay, let me try an analogy to clarify how this ICA is fundamentally different from just grouping things together.
Go for it.
Think of taking a complex mixed audio recording of a massive symphony orchestra.
Okay.
Traditional clustering might just tell you that the loud parts happened at the same time. But ICA mathematically unmixes that single audio file into completely separate, isolated tracks.
Yes.
It isolates the individual frequency of the drums, the isolated violins, the horns, even if they're all playing over top of one another.
Yeah.
So ICA isolates the specific underlying genetic tracks or regulatory signals that E. coli is playing at any given moment.
That is a perfect analogy. The algorithm successfully unmixed the data set into 137 of these independent imodulins, or tracks.
137, wow.
And out of those 137, the researchers identified 25 that were specifically mechanistically linked to carbon catabolism.
So the genes responsible for sensing, importing, and eating different carbon sources.
Exactly. And by zooming in on those 25 specific carbon eating tracks, a highly detailed map of the E. coli universe just snaps into focus.
Which is where things get really cool.
Yeah. When they observed how these tracks behaved across the 43 different diets, they found the meals naturally clustered into 4 distinct groups.
Based entirely on the bacteria's genetic reaction.
Right. They labeled them groups A through D. Group A is essentially, well, the VIP section of the buffet.
The easy stuff.
Right. It contains the preferred highly efficient sugars. When E. coli consumes these substrates, it achieves very high growth rates, like a median of 0.56 divisions per hour.
That's fast.
The biomass yield is phenomenal. And crucially, we see a very low need for genetic remodeling.
So the cell doesn't have to stress out or activate alternative tracks.
Nope. The metabolic engine is running smoothly, pouring its entire ribosomal budget into pure growth.
But then you look at the other extreme, group D. These are the meals you only eat when you have absolutely no other choice.
Yeah, group D consists of highly complex substrates like nucleosides and certain amino acids.
Struggle meal.
Total struggle meals. The cellular experience here is drastically different. the growth rate just plummets.
Because it's so hard to digest.
Exactly. Extracting basic carbon and energy from these molecular structures is incredibly difficult, so the cell is forced to heavily engage a wide variety of alternative catabolic modules.
Alongside multiple stress response tracks.
Right. And let's talk about how this new data completely rewrites the rules, starting with the CRP pathway we discussed earlier.
Oh, this is fascinating. Because the old textbook model claimed the CRP system, the hunger sensor, was a single binary master switch.
Right.
But this deep dive shatters that binary myth.
Completely. When the researchers applied the independent component analysis, that broad CRP genetic network did not show up as one unified track.
The math proved the biology is way more complex.
Yeah, the single CRP network actually decomposed into three statistically separable imodulins, which the team named CRP1, CRP2, and CRP3.
Wait, so the cellular factory boss doesn't just have one giant red button on the wall?
No. The cell is operating a highly sophisticated control panel. These three separate CRP modules are deployed in varying combinations and to different degrees.
Depending on the specific environment.
Exactly. We are looking at a highly nuanced graded response. The bacterium fine-tunes its metabolic machinery, pulling different biological levers depending on exactly how poor or complex the nutrient environment is.
Rather than just indiscriminately turning everything on at once.
Right, which would be a waste of energy.
And this granular control becomes literally a matter of life and death. When we look at how E. coli digests the really tough meals, the group C and group D substrates.
Yeah, this is where the stress comes in.
Because when the bacteria eat these foods, the researchers saw the activation of two specific genetic tracks. The NTRC1I modulin, which is normally associated with nitrogen regulation, and the propionate I modulin.
And here's the thing, the cell isn't just trying to extract energy here.
No, it's actively trying to survive a self-inflicted poisoning.
We are seeing a profound example of condition-specific metabolic stress. We have to look at the cellular assembly line again.
Okay, walk me through it.
So preferred sugars, like glucose, enter the factory at the very beginning of the metabolic process, a pathway called glycolysis. It's a clean, straightforward breakdown.
Right.
However, many of the complex substrates in groups C and D bypass that initial pathway. They enter the metabolic engine much later, directly into the deep, highly efficient engine of the cell known as the TCA cycle, or the Krebs cycle.
And the biological danger there is that digesting these specific diets generates a chemical byproduct called propionyl-CoA.
Yes.
And propionyl-CoA is highly toxic because it essentially mimics the normal molecules the TCA cycle expects.
Right.
So it physically gums up the gears of the cellular engine.
The enzymes of the TCA cycle accidentally bind to the propionyl-CoA, which stalls the entire cycle. It sequesters vital metabolic intermediates and inhibits the cell's ability to generate cellular energy and, well, breathe.
Wow, so the cell doesn't clear this toxin, it dies.
It dies. So to survive eating these specific diets, the cell is forced to activate the propionate I modulin.
And what does that track do?
It encodes a secondary set of reactions called the methyl citrate pathway. This pathway acts as a specialized molecular waste disposal system, basically converting the toxic propionyl-CoA into harmless intermediates that the cell can safely manage.
And what's really amazing is that the researchers didn't just rely on the mathematical model to prove this.
No, they did the physical biology too.
Right. They went into the lab and genetically deleted the PRPC gene, which codes for a critical enzyme in that waste disposal system.
And the results are striking.
When they knocked out that single gene, it completely crippled the bacteria's ability to grow on the group C and D diets. The bacteria effectively poisoned themselves.
But, and here's the key, deleting that exact same gene had absolutely zero effect on their ability to eat glucose.
Because when they ate glucose, they didn't generate the propionyl-CoA toxin in the first place, so they never needed the disposal system.
Exactly. The allocation logic is flawless. The cell only diverts its precious ribosomal budget to construct the waste disposal system when the chemical reality of its food source demands it.
It's so efficient. But speaking of where the cell allocates its budget, while we're on the topic of strange genetic tracks, we have to explore the cryptic prophage mystery found in this dataset.
Oh, this was one of the most unexpected findings.
Truly bizarre. So when the bacteria were subsisting on the group D substrates, which are notably nitrogen rich, and release large amounts of ammonium during digestion, the bacteria triggered a specific module called SGCABCQMEX.
Which is a mouthful.
It is. But this module is essentially a cryptic prophage. And just for context for the listener, a prophage is old, leftover viral DNA from an ancient infection that got permanently integrated and stuck in the bacteria's genome.
Right, ancient viral code.
But on these poor diets, the activity of this ancient viral DNA spiked by 16 to 25 fold.
Which is crazy because activating dormant viral DNA is typically a massive risk for a bacterium, making this an incredibly bizarre biological response to a poor diet.
See, I have to push back on the logic here. If this is just defective viral DNA from a random infection millions of years ago, isn't the bacterium just wasting its incredibly limited energy by transcribing it?
It seems like it, right?
Yeah. If you are a starving cell operating under strict proteome allocation rules, why print useless viral junk?
Well, the researchers asked that exact question. Because from a budget perspective, printing useless RNA is a fatal error.
So they tested it?
Yes. They tested the function of this viral DNA by knocking out the SGC genes in the lab. And interestingly, deleting them did not negatively impact the bacteria's baseline growth.
Wait, really? So it didn't do anything?
Well, that's what they thought at first. But the ICA math revealed a hidden layer. There was a very strong, statistically significant coactivation between this viral SGC module and a separate, highly specific sugar processing module called sulfoconobos.
Okay, sulfoconobos is a complex, sulfur-containing sugar often found in plant diets, right?
Exactly.
So the viral DNA and the plant sugar processing genes are firing concurrently.
Yes. And in systems biology, when independent genetic modules consistently fire together across multiple environments, it strongly implies they're working together structurally or metabolically.
So they're a team.
Right. And the compelling hypothesis here is that E. coli has actually domesticated this ancient viral DNA.
Domesticated it.
Yeah. It may have repurposed the structural proteins of the old virus, perhaps the proteins the virus once used to bind to cell walls as a novel, highly specific scavenging tool.
Wow. Just to capture and import complex environmental carbohydrate.
Exactly. The cell isn't wasting energy. It has integrated a foreign tool into its survival kit, deploying it only when traditional food is scarce.
That is wild. And it all builds to the overarching theme of this deep dive, which is the grand trade-off between growth and stress. You truly cannot prioritize both.
You really can't. The proteome allocation numbers tell the full story. The dataset clearly shows that when the bacteria are forced onto the poor diets of groups C and D, the translation I modulon drops precipitously.
And that's the one responsible for manufacturing ribosomes for actual physical cell growth, right?
Exactly. Growth machinery plummets. And simultaneously, we see a massive spike in the RPS I modulon.
The panic button.
Right. RPS is the master stress regulator. It is the ultimate cellular alarm system that rewrites the genome's priorities to focus entirely on defense and survival.
And the researchers actually quantified this trade-off using metabolic models. They found that E. coli has to assign up to 16% of its entire available protein budget just to handle the complex catabolism and the immense chemical stress associated with eating group D substrates.
16% is a massive tax.
It is. That 16% stress tax leaves drastically fewer resources for building new cells, which perfectly explains why the physical growth rate on those diets is so agonizingly slow.
It makes perfect sense when you see the numbers.
But this atlas paints a beautiful picture of what happens when E. coli is steadily growing on a single source, having reached a balanced state of dealing with whatever food is present.
Right, steady state.
But the environment in a mammalian gut isn't steady. What happens if you suddenly pull the primary nutrient out from under the cell?
Well, to test real-world dynamics, the research team conducted an independent time course experiment.
Okay.
They grew the bacteria happily on preferred glucose and then abruptly removed all glucose from the environment. They forced the bacteria into starvation for 12 hours and then suddenly reintroduced the glucose.
This is the physiological panic scenario. I mean, if the textbook binary switch model was correct, you'd expect a neat sequential progression, right? The glucose switch turns off, and then the alternative pathways turn on one by one in an orderly fashion.
That's what you would expect. But the time course data proved the exact opposite.
Really?
Yeah. The genetic tracks did not fire in a strict sequential assembly line. When starvation hit, the CRP modules, the propionate waste disposal module, the NTRC1 nitrogen stress module, they all activated with overlapping concurrent kinetics.
It's as if the cell slammed both hands on the dashboard, hitting every panic button and deploying every domesticated tool it had simultaneously, just desperately searching the environment for anything it could metabolize.
That's a great visual. And critically, when the glucose was finally returned to the environment, all of those various stress and alternative diet modules rapidly dialed back down in real time.
So it recovered quickly.
Yes. And this proves that the static mapping they built from steady lab conditions accurately represents dynamic real-world panics. The cell is continuously adjusting its protein budget second by second as the chemical reality of its environment shifts.
That is so cool. And we also have to acknowledge the evolutionary fingerprints left all over this atlas. Because not all strains of E. coli are identical.
Oh, definitely not.
Some live in the human gut, others in agricultural soil, others in water systems.
Right, and the researchers compared their genetic modules across different evolutionary lineages of E. coli.
And what did they find?
They discovered that the genes encoding the CRP modules, you know, that core foundational sensing machinery, they are deeply conserved across almost all E. coli phylogroups.
It represents universal survival gear that every strain requires to function.
Exactly. But the weird domesticated viral DNA, the SGC prophage, tells a completely different story.
Right, because that prophage module is highly lineage specific.
Yes. It is only present in certain distinct branches of the E. coli family tree.
Which implies that different strains constantly customize their genetic toolkits based on the specific ecological niches they inhabit.
Absolutely. If a strain evolves in a niche where it frequently encounters complex, nitrogen-rich plant substrates, the evolutionary pressure forces it to retain that domesticated viral tool.
But if a strain migrates to an environment where it never sees those substrates,
it eventually deletes the viral genes to save precious genome space and optimize its ribosomal budget.
Use it or lose it. So, bringing this all together, why does it matter that we have replaced a simple binary switch with a 137-track mathematical atlas?
I mean, this shift is foundational for systems biology. On one level, it allows us to accurately predict how bacterial populations will behave in incredibly complex, shifting ecosystems like the human microbiome.
That's huge.
We can begin to truly model how the bacteria in your digestive tract alter their metabolism in response to the specific, varied combinations of complex carbohydrates you eat.
And on an applied level, it provides synthetic biologists with a crucial roadmap.
Exactly. Because if an engineer wants to program a microbe to consume cheap plant waste and convert it into a valuable biofuel or, say, the life-saving medicine, they must know how to feed that cell without inadvertently triggering massive stress panic.
Because if the engineered diet accidentally forces the cell to spend 16% of its budget on toxic waste disposal and RPOS stress alarms,
the factory won't produce the desired medicine. It's too busy surviving. This atlas tells us how to keep the cellular engine running smoothly and efficiently.
It's incredible. E. coli doesn't just have one lever to pull when its food source changes. It is not a simple machine.
Right.
Using this 43 substrate atlas, we see a master conductor dynamically deploying dozens of independent genetic modules.
It's beautiful, really.
It is. It constantly balances the high energetic costs of digesting tough foods, clearing toxic molecular byproducts, and managing stress, all while meticulously budgeting its ribosomes to keep the fundamental machinery of life moving.
And this dynamic complexity leaves us with a really fascinating final thought.
Oh, what's that?
Well, we just saw how ancient, left-behind viral DNA can be reactivated and deployed as a scavenging tool simply because a single bacterium is forced to survive on a poor diet.
Yeah, the domesticated virus.
Right. So if these microscopic organisms are that radically resourceful, what does this mean for how the trillions of bacteria in your own gut might be reacting, adapting, and rewriting their genetic priorities right now in response to the complex shifting nutrients you feed them every single day?
That is a lot to think about. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
One master switch hums.
then the side streets come alive. Modules in the wire and telling growth how to survive. Turn the dial, graded signals, not a single on or flare. Fast lane, sync translation, slow roads, know the stress in air. Different doors to energy, but the map stays crystal clear. It's modular fire and the sugar.
Essential for the moment, but it tells you what it means.
When growth rate drops, the cell pays rent in RPO's time. Less for building rival souls, more to hold the line.
It's modular fire in the sugar light.
Stress in the basement.
Data in flight.
Four kinds of carbon stories, clustered by the pace. An atlas for the hunger and the choices cells will face. So tune the cell. Engineer, explore, read the graded modules, and you'll open